nice to see all the CEOs at a bipartisan, lobby group to talk about the industry, and got to meet Karl Rove and David Axelrod. So that was interesting. But I didn't think the two of them could shake hands. I thought that the universe would explode if they came into contact with each other. But as it turns out, they had a really good bipartisan conversation about where we're at, right?
But tell me something. So Karl Rove was I don't want to say chief of staff, but he might have been for Bush number two. I want to say the last good Republican that was in the White House, but I'm not sure. I mean, I think that's actually probably true, isn't it?
That's probably true. Yeah. So I voted. I'll tell you, just to be clear, I'm not translucent about my politics, but or opaque about my politics. But I voted for both of their candidates. Right. So Karl Rove was the kingmaker behind Bush the second. And he made an interesting quip about how he had given the Governor Bush at the time, a list of 8 reasons why not to bring Dick Cheney into his campaign. And I thought that was really interesting, because I guess he had voted against the interests of the party, or voted against, you know, what other Republicans were supporting at the time. But, I thought he was all for Cheney. And then when Cheney and Bush finally won and it was all cleared, a young David Axelrod started coming out with reasons why Cheney should not have been part of the administration. And he basically stole Karl Rove's entire list, especially his first three, and got all the credit for it as well. But at the time, Karl was like, well, that SOB said we shouldn't have Cheney as part of our administration. And so he had to pretend that he actually liked Cheney at the time. It was interesting, but they have a long history of competing with candidates. And I thought it was cool to see them on stage.
Hold on. Yeah. Hold on 1 second.
Did you follow that?
It was long winded. But I got most of it. I was kind of stuck on a few points, which is to the one listener we might have.
Yep.
The Cheney you're referring to was the VP for Bush number two.
That's right.
And
I refer to him as daughter, Darth Vader. Darth Vader, sure.
Oh, really? Yeah. He was a little evil. And the daughter was Liz Cheney, who actually seems to have proven to be a sort of a knight in, or knightess or whatever, in shining armor when it came to the hearings on the January 6th debacle.
She really did a great job. She really proved her leadership abilities and her ability to kind of buck the system and say, you know, I'm going to say what I believe and I'm going to stand up for what's right. And I admire her for that. She still votes, you know, with him most of the time. But at the same time, it was brave of her to do so, ending her own congressional, career. But I think winning over a lot of people and standing up for what was right. So.
Well, so she agreed. And then where you lost me was Axelrod, so far as I know, is simply a Democratic operative. I don't recall his being anything other than behind the scenes, but remind me who Axelrod was.
David Axelrod. David Axelrod ran Obama's campaign, right? And I believe he was his first chief of staff as well as they transitioned, but maybe I was wrong. Maybe he did end at the campaign and continued to support him from behind the scenes, but he was a bit of a whip and certainly a political genius and, operative, I guess is what you would call it. But I thought that he was chief of staff. I could be completely wrong.
Well, okay, that might be. I don't recall that, but it doesn't matter. So the other thing is, you thought sparks would fly. I don't think this was Rove you meant, not Cheney. You meant Rove.
Yeah.
I mean, Rove seems. I don't really know much about Cheney's sort of out of office activities, but Rove seems like a thinker, mm-hmm. and Axelrod is clearly a thinker. And I don't actually think your comment about something derogatory, and that's, which is fine. I'm not passing judgment on it per se about Rove. I guess my view is that now, looking back at it from a Trumpian or a post-Trumpian point of view, I think my view is that I can deal with these days. I'm more aligned with Democrats.
Sure.
But I can deal with old school Republicans, Bush 2, Bush 1, et cetera.
Oh, it's refreshing to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I can deal with them. It's just a different point of view, but at least it's it falls within democratic norms.
Norms, that's right.
So I think this, I think Trump is well outside that.
Yeah.
And so I guess it's fine. So your comment about Rove is, well, I don't necessarily agree with him, but in the end, I see the Republican view as aligned with, let's support Ukraine. Their views on abortion don't necessarily align with mine, but the flip side is, I'm not sure that where we've come out is, I know I probably politically incorrect to say this, but I'm not sure it's a whole lot worse. The number of abortions is up, and I assume the people who need to be getting them are getting them. And hopefully this Mifepristo thing, the hearing, was it today? Was that, is it Mifepristo?
I believe so, yeah.
Hopefully they won't outlaw that. And if they do, maybe there'll be some other technique. So overall, I'm kind of fine with politics the way it used to be.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't necessarily agree with the Republican stance on abortion. I think there should be exceptions, and just to be candid, there was a congresswoman from, I want to say, Arizona, who spoke up yesterday about her recent pregnancy and said, I don't know if you know this, but I'm pregnant and I've had a number of miscarriages in the past, and it's a very difficult subject for me. But the reason why I'm sharing this with you is because the pregnancy is not viable and I have to have an abortion, and I'm going to have an abortion, and it's the right decision for me and my family. And I think it's only right that we as a body, as a legislative body, ensure that women are able to make decisions for their health and for that of their family without us being involved. And so, you know, while abortion is, you know, I think it's an awful decision to have to make, and it's a terrible thing, and you'd never want to be put in that situation where you have to make that decision, it's none of my business. It's not my business. My religion keeps me from doing things. It doesn't keep you from doing things. And your religion keeps you from doing things. It doesn't keep me from doing things. And that separation of church and state is what's really at stake. Is, you know, if you want me to claim, you know, my frozen embryos on my taxes as dependents because they're people, then let's have that conversation. But if you think that, you know, if you think that it's your right to determine what women can do when their life is threatened by a pregnancy that has been affected by trisomy 18 or something else that causes a need for a medical intervention, then that's on you. And that's a big, big problem, right? So I think that there's, you know, certainly merit to both sides of the conversation. But when you take out, you know, the exemptions for rape and incest, you make it not something worth even considering.
Well, how did you feel about, as I recall, Roe v. Wade, it's been a while, but I recall it was all about fetal viability in the third trimester. Did you buy into that, or did you think there should be abortions after that as well?
Oh, God, no. No, I think after the third trimester, I mean, there's also life-threatening chances, right? So, you know, I had a family member who had a stillbirth at 28 weeks, right? And it was the fetus was not viable and had some challenges. And that was one of the most painful things that my family had to go through, you know, be in the room to support that individual. But as a family, the hardest thing we ever had to witness. And again, it's between us, our doctors and our God. And it has nothing to do with legislation, or the doctors shouldn't hold back from any decisions they would make to save that patient's life, to take the best care of that potentially viable birth, and do what they need to do as medical scientists. Right. But if you,
how do you feel about sort of going back to Roe, or no, the more recent case,
Dobbs?
And this is not, again, I haven't studied that at all. So it's just my recollection about Dobbs was, in the end, what it did was remove Roe as a
standard,
as the test. And basically allowed each state to define its own or come up with its own laws regarding abortion.
Yeah,
how do you feel like putting this all? And so how do you feel about that? Because to me, I'm not sure that's the worst answer. I personally liked where Roe put us, and overturning it 50 or so years later struck me as odd.
Oddly
political. But
yeah,
go ahead. No,
especially when the justices during their interviews to become, you know, to as nominees said, hey, this is established law and this is what we all believe. And they completely lied to the American public about their views on that, and then inserted their opinions based on their leanings politically. So I think that is absolutely wrong. I think when you're interviewing somebody and they tell you what their position is, that's what their expected position is. It doesn't magically change 3 months later when they need to satisfy the person that paid off their mortgage.
That's a different issue.
Well, maybe.
Lie to me once. Lie to me twice. Shame on me.
Yeah, so, that's fair.
I mean, I think. It's politics.
I do want to know who paid off Kavanaugh's mortgage and his gambling debts, though. That would be nice to have a disclosure of the Freedom of Information Act
I get all that, and a lot of that still falls in the realm of, I hope it only falls in the realm of politics ethics violations that are.
But there are no ethics violations for the Supreme Court. There's no such thing.
Well, okay.
Did you see John Oliver's show at all? Do you ever watch John Oliver?
I think I got really. Was it John Oliver? What's the one where he used to be good, but then he was on during COVID? Whoever it was, he had a show.
John Stewart
who had a show.
Yeah, that was terrible.
John Oliver, it was John Stewart. I confused the two. John Oliver, I've never watched. John Stewart was like a comedy, but I don't think it was supposed to be.
John Stewart, I like John Stewart. I think he's a brilliant person. I think he should be in politics, but I thought that the HBO show that he did kind of bombed. It was very angry and wasn't really in the same spirit of his late shows on Comedy Central. I liked watching The Late Show, or the, you know, Jon Stewart's show on Comedy Central. That was really witful and insightful and used comedy to diffuse and start that discourse. John Oliver, though, I think is a comic genius in his own right. And he's got a show. He was started with Jon Stewart. He's got a show on HBO now called Last Week Tonight. And apparently they're always working on about six stories at a time, and they start a story 6 weeks out. But one of the things he covered for an entire episode was Clarence Thomas. And Clarence Thomas has to be the most corrupt justice that has ever sat on the court, because in the 1999, hold on, let me just tell this. 1999, he basically said, hey, I can't live on this salary. If I don't get paid more, I'm going to quit. And so a bunch of billionaires came to the rescue and started lavishly throwing gifts at him, trips and flights on private jets and yachts and vacations, and helped him buy a $400,000 motorhome. And then forgave the loan, right? Gave him advantageous benefits, and then forgave the loan. So what John Oliver did in all his brilliance is he said, listen, that motorhome you've got is kind of dated. So what I'm willing to do is I'm going to give you a brand new motorhome, and it's actually a coach. It's worth about $1.5 million. And I will give you, out of my own pocket, $1 million a year as a salary if you step off the fucking Supreme Court. That's what he said. He said, you've got 30 days,
yeah.
TikTok. And it basically pointed out the absurd conflict of interest when the people who were forgiving these loans had business before the court, and there was no recusal, no ethical checks, no declarations of or disclosures. And that's a big problem when you have a life appointment, right? So that's kind of where I'm at with the Supreme Court is there's so much.
Yeah, but hold on. Let's go back.
Okay.
Yeah, but okay. So I hear all that. And from what I, from that, what you just said in my reading of the Times, which is, you know, left-leaning, the New York Times, which is clearly sure. left-leaning, I assume accurate, but still they have a view. What yep. you said seemed like it matched what I had read, but I'm I'm just thinking, just like, you know, lie to me once, shame on you, lie to me twice, shame on me. I'm sort of thinking, yeah, I hear you. All that, all those are bad things. And I assume they're true, but I don't know that they're true. But clearly there's some marks in his, she's got a sort of, it sounds like a somewhat of a checkered past when it comes to the non-existent ethics. But I think that's probably likely true of any number of justices over the years.
Of course.
So let's just put all that aside.
Yeah, sure.
But let's put all that aside. And to me, the one thing we know for sure is true is what Dobbs said, which is you took this. I think we both agree that Roe was a reasonably thought out decision and was sure. a reasonable regime to operate under for 50 years. Yep. And that changed last year. It was last year. Feels like it was this year. But I'm not sure what the way it changed things was really, notwithstanding all the, you sort of, when you step outside of your own echo chamber, I'm not sure where it put us was all that bad. In my mind, it's a little, is it Machiavellian or is it Darwinian or is it Adam Smith? But it really comes down to, look, if you in Alabama don't want women to have abortions after the, day three or whatever you come up with, fine, do it. Let's see how many people moved to your state, you know, and if you in Texas don't want to do X, we're talking about abortion now. We're not talking about immigration.
Or burning books.
Let's see how many people live in your state. And in the end, I have to admit, it could lead to more polarization. And maybe that's the effect everyone should really be talking about. But sure. I don't inherently mind the idea of states defining abortion rights and then people will choose with their feet. That the only problem in my mind then, as long as you don't go too far and start violating the Ten Commandments, is the only thing that I mind is that will lead to more polarization. If everyone leaves Alabama
by the way, deaths, right? So some of these women that are in states that they can't have abortions and they can't travel or they have a health condition or they're, so as an advocate for women's health care, I have to say that I find the idea that states can limit what women do for health procedures to be abhorrent, right? And yeah, people are going to vote with their feet and they're going to move to different places, but if they can't cross state lines when they're pregnant, or if they have some big brother observing their menstrual cycles, that's a problem. That's a violation of our civil and human rights.
Maybe it is. The flip side is, you know, I agree though, the devil's somewhat in the details, which is
sure.
I'll still argue over time people vote with their feet.
Yep,
and over time, Alabama will become peopled with will have a population that's of a certain bent. I just don't know.
I think they already might be bent that way, David. That's the problem. So it's a limited gene pool is what we're saying. But it's okay. It's all right. Just let's be honest with our words. So there's the other
listener down there. So don't say anything.
the other Thomas recusal observation was that his wife factually, and we know this for a fact, paid to bus people to the January 6th insurrection. So she literally was part of a group organizing to send people to storm the Capitol building and had planned it for months. And now her husband, Clarence Thomas, our Supreme Court justice, who's sworn for life and is supposed to uphold the Constitution, has a spouse who was undermining that constitution and the process for the transfer of power.
What do you do about all this? I hear you. By the way, I want to say
he would be supposed to recuse himself from the conversation around whether or not the president is immune while he's in office staging an insurrection, right? You know, common courtesy.
Hold on. Two things. Did you know the Tower of Power is still around?
Tower of Power, the music?
Yeah, no, not just the music, the group. They're I just, you know, because I'm driving, as you can tell. They're I just saw a big sign. They're playing up the Lynn, wherever Lynn is. That's just up to you, I think. It's further north than you.
No, I thought it was it was the Encore.
Oh, I thought that said Lynn something or other, but Tower of Power. I don't think there are many people alive who still remember what that is. That was like a, it wasn't jazz. It was pop funk slash whatever band that was heavy with, who was the guy who got thrown in? Who was the, gosh, what was the name of the producer, on the tip of my tongue, who got thrown in jail because in the end he was a nut, but it was his sound.
Was he murdering people? Phil, what's his name?
Yeah. Phil Spector.
Good Lord.
Well, isn't Tower of Power a Phil Spector production?
I think it is, but it's not like he killed anyone.
Oh, he didn't? I thought he did.
Oh, no, he definitely did. He definitely killed people. Sorry. I was wrong on that one. But so we got to get some Tower of Power in this. What is hip?
So hold on. I guess what bothers me, and that bothers me, I don't mean to be passive about this.
Yeah.
But the thing is that the things that are easy to attack in the echo chamber are things like that. That in this case being what Clarence Thomas's wife did or didn't do.
But she did, though. That's factual. It's not debatable.
But what are you going to do about it? I mean, the bottom line is he ought to recuse himself, but he's not going to.
Right.
He said that.
He doesn't have to.
And what she's done is not illegal.
Yes, it is. It's participating in an insurrection. It's aiding and abetting insurrection.
I doubt she, by the way, I don't recall that anybody, that any of the, what do we call them? The January 6th heroes. I don't recall that any of the January 6th heroes, that, by the way, heroes of Trump's word, not mine.
Yeah.
But I don't recall that any of them are actually charged with insurrection. Oh, wait a minute.
Seditious conspiracy.
Were guys.
Yeah, they were. Some of them were charged with.
That was like three of them, though, or two of them. They were from the Proud Boys or the other thing that seems very similar to the Proud Boys.
Yeah, the Oath Keepers.
Oath Keepers, same thing. So I don't know. I guess, I don't know is there a difference between insurrection and seditious conspiracy? I'm assuming generally not.
Yeah, there is. So insurrection, it can be impromptu. It can be, hey, we're here, let's go do this. It can be, you know, the bar next door, and then they decide they want to interfere. But seditious conspiracy requires coordination. It's premeditated. It requires, you know, planning and coordination, and that's what they did. And she was coordinating to bus people to this event, knowing there was going to be weapons, knowing there'd be violence, knowing there was an intent to block a constitutional process.
Why would she have known there were going to be weapons?
Because they were fomenting this, and they knew they were coordinating with the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys and these people holed up at motels outside of D.C. proper, ready to storm the Capitol with weapons.
Yes, but how do we know that she knew that?
The Select Committee provided evidence.
That she knew that?
Yeah, that all of them were in cahoots.
No.
Yep.
No. I think there were a large number. I think there were certainly instigators. And I think the bottom line is, I think it's great that the heroes are in jail. I have not heard their song, but I gather it's somewhat fetching. I think it's great they're in jail, and I think the Justice Department has done well with them. I think that the Wall Street Journal and others have a point that it's not entirely clear what should happen with Trump as a result of all this. I don't think it's perfectly clear at all. especially given his position. I guess so. I'm more hesitant. She's not Trump, and Trump only had limited knowledge. So I just don't know. I just think that it's easy to throw this stuff around, but I feel like day to day we have shit to get done, and the stuff that needs to get done is like today when they passed the budget, right?
Right.
They passed the I think it went through. Oh no, the House did, but the Senate House didn't yet.
Right.
But I assume the Senate will. So I guess what am I trying to say? I think
I'd like to understand.
Okay. I think it's easy to step inside the echo chamber and throw things around. And I wish things weren't that way, but I'm not the ruler of the universe.
Oh, I
get
it. So
I can't make everyone act. Yeah. And so that's why I feel like a lot of these discussions get wrapped up in sort of peripheral mudslinging.
Right. Well, these aren't pot shots. These are the core of our elected representative government. Right. And if we have norms and a constitution and rule of law and all of these things, which I assume you believe are good things, then we have to follow them. And there needs to be accountability for breaking those oaths, breaking those laws, you know, participating in corrupt criminal activity, supporting insurrection, all those things. Right. We need to nip that in the bud, or it invites more of the same. And I just fear that when a political candidate says, hey, if I don't win, there's going to be a bloodbath. Hey, join us on the January 6th. We'll be wild. You know, there's ways of fomenting insurrection and civil war and other things that I think we're in the midst of already. I think when we look back at 2020 through 2028 or whatever it is, that this will say this was the beginning of the second American Civil War, and it went on, and it was a cold civil war. No, it's happening right now. There's one side that's been plotting for 50 plus years to get certain legislation in place. And you laugh, David, but I follow this not just inside the echo chamber. I'm listening to both sides and what they're saying. And they have a plan. It's called 2025 to cut your Social Security, to ban abortion federally, to put all these things in place. And they've said it. They've put it on paper. It's not hearsay.
Yeah,
it's
okay.
Not hyperbolic.
So it's a free country. It's a free country. You know, let's go back before you get too far into the echo chamber and start having echoes on your echoes. I do believe in the Constitution. I believe in all those things, and I think they're great. But so far as I know, the Constitution does not paint the picture of an angelic person, and it wasn't intended to, and it wasn't intended to define what every person should look like and think like, nor act like.
You're right.
It defines some fundamental principles. And what's important is it's just I think it is actually literally a piece of paper with ink on it. Boy, by the way, somehow I've never understood this, but I went from Cambridge to what must have been Charleston or Charlestown or whatever. Whatever it's called. And now I'm in Boston. What a weird, who knew these things were connected? It's just a piece of paper with ink on it. And what it defines is a set of, I don't even want to call them rules, by which people, whether it's jurors or judges at the lower courts or the justices of the Supreme Court, can interpret and decide whether any individuals or I suppose entities, activities fall outside the scope of what's permissible, you know, given all the laws and stuff.
Sure.
So I believe in all those things, but I don't believe that everyone should be the same. And,
no.
You know, like I said, I liked the Bushes. I didn't love the Bushes. I hated the younger one's voice.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were kind of all going in the same direction, which is we're allowed to push the envelope within within the scope of permissive activities.
There you go. Now we're talking the same language.
Yeah, but I don't think I don't think a lot of those. I think the people, the heroes of January 6th, who did definably wrong acts. There are laws that I believe say that you can't
kill a police officer
inside the.
Sure.
Was it like that? And break the windows of the house. I think all those things, and that's what they should be charged with. And apparently a few of them were charged and convicted of seditious conspiracy, but not the majority. But there was a whole lot of people on the periphery, including Clarence Thomas's wife, who I think was taking advantage of, you know, perhaps her position or whatever, and encouraged some activities that I find unsavory, but I'm not sure and I'm not willing to believe until the courts convict her of it or not, that it's and it's not what I would do, but I don't know that I can say much more about it.
No, that's fair.
It's got to go through the process.
So let me respond to what your comment. Your comment was about the Constitution not saying that everybody had to be angels. I'm not suggesting that whatsoever. But what the Constitution did do was safeguard our, we'll call it a republic or, you know, representative democracy, whatever you want to call it, ensure that we wouldn't fall victim to demagoguery and prevent a certain type of individual from claiming power and retaining power, and therefore set the example of stepping down as president when he could have been monarch or king or oligarch or whatever you want to call it. But he intentionally said, I'm not going to be that because I want you to see that this democratic process that we're setting up is to prevent demagoguery. So I believe the Constitution was put in place to prevent someone like Trump from controlling the house of power and the executive branch of government, right?
I agree with all that, but my view is that you're jumping around a lot here, and that you're using sort of snippets of facts combined with you sort of opinion to attack the right. And in general, I think the right can't live without the left, and vice versa.
Okay, so let's attack the left. Let's attack the left. I'm fine with that too.
My point is that I sort of think what's happening now,
sure,
is what needs to happen. Ultimately, I trust the courts. Any individual court, no, but it's part of the sausage making process.
Yeah,
it's part of the sausage making process, which is this country. Trump has by the courts been found to be guilty of some things, literally guilty of some things, and has been recused of others. And that's fine. I'd like to see the process play out. I don't like the fact that if he is reelected, he might actually put the kibosh on proceedings that affect him. But I acknowledge that'll happen. And I think the Supreme Court, as much as I don't kind of like their leanings, I got to think they're kind of trying to do the right thing. I think that they appreciate that some of what's going on with Trump. I thought about this the other day when you read articles, when you read commentators, and I tend to read commentators on the left, talking about what the Supreme Court is doing in terms of delaying or at least adding to the delay of the Trump trials.
Right.
I'm not entirely convinced they're doing. I think they may be doing that on purpose. And it made me think maybe that's good, because I think some of what we're seeing in the echo chamber, or whatever the visual equivalent of it is overblown. Again, I think I don't like Trump. I don't like his seeming amorality.
But you trust the Supreme Court.
I don't. It's sausage making. I don't love the Supreme Court, but it's sausage making.
Well, we just talked about how
sometimes Sometimes when you bite your sausage, you need a piece of gristle.
I get it. I understand. So, but we just talked about how they stepped in and took something that was precedent and decided law, and then decided on their own that they're the ones that get to decide for the entire country what is and what is not law, right? So this is a powerful body. They're appointed for life. They're there for decades now and will affect generations of Americans through their decisions.
Well,
and
what do you think Roe did? What do you think Roe did? Roe did all those things, and so did the Bakke decision. When the Supreme Court speaks, things tend to change.
They do.
I can imagine there were a lot of people on the right back in whether they're in Alabama or somewhere else back when Roe was decided 50 years ago, who were like, hey, who are these people? The answer is that's part of the sausage making process, and I like where Roe left us.
Yeah.
I thought it was a reasonable position, but times have changed.
Is this just the pendulum swinging, as Bader Ginsburg would say? This is the pendulum; it swung, and it's going to swing back. I mean, what is the I guess my point is, if the court is corrupt and beholden to specific oligarchs and billionaires like Crow others.
Come on.
Harlan Crow? You don't think that Harlan Crow has his hands on Clarence Thomas and makes decisions for the court? You don't think so?
No. No, I think.
Because he's the one that bought him the motorhome. He's the one that bought him a $400,000 motorhome, right?
Yeah. I don't think it looks good. Clarence Thomas is clearly a bright guy. And from some of the things the excerpts I've heard from his book, he sounds like he has issues of bitterness, but he's clearly, who doesn't, but he's clearly a super bright guy.
Absolutely.
I think he's able to make a decision on his own. And I assume he's able to separate out the views of people who's like Carlin Crow. I'm hoping he's doing that. And I think that his buddies and whatever women buddies that would be called on the Supreme Court feel as well.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate your perspective on that. I think that it's, an interesting perspective sprinkled with facts. But, I just know from what I've discovered, and I hope that you'll watch.
No facts.
I hope that you'll watch the John Oliver segment on it. It's 50 minutes of brilliance on the topic, and it brings out all the facts, right? And so, and it's not an echo chamber. I think he's really good at making fun of both sides. He's really good at pointing out the inadequacy. Even our Democrats are not, these are not left-leaning Democrats. Our president is a centrist, right? He's probably more Republican than George Bush Jr. was back in the 90s, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know, and certainly the modern definition of Republican is so far off.
Yeah.
I don't know about that, but I think it's true that he's not a so-called progressive.
No. By no means.
Regardless, I happen to like his views.
Yeah, yeah. Some of them I agree with, and some of them I now abhor because of what's been going on recently. But how do you feel about things like Citizens United that says that money is speech and corporations are people, and therefore our government is controlled by corporations, right? Raytheon, Boeing, right? How do you feel about that?
So if I'm not mistaken, Citizens United stood for the proposition that what corporations, do they not have to be disclosed if they make contributions, or their contributions can be in unlimited amounts? I've forgotten exactly
what
Citizens United said. Can you? Yeah.
Essentially, it said that money is speech. Corporations are people, and therefore have the right to contribute unlimited funds without traceability to super PACs and PACs, okay, political action committees. So essentially,
I don't know the answer to that. Do you?
Yeah. Well, I think if we're going to have a country of political norms where the best interest of the country is served, then you can't have dark foreign money flowing into Congress, paying off congressmen that are then going to vote with foreign interests as opposed to American interests. That's how I feel.
I don't remember Citizens United addressing. I don't remember hearing that it addressed foreign corporations. I thought it was we're talking largely U.S. Concerns.
Yeah, but again, U.S. corporations are owned by lots of different holdings, right? So if you look at who really controls the country right now, this is not the echo chamber or otherwise. Yeah, it's the BlackRocks of the world that own all of the major corporations that have, 15% of Boeing and 15% of Raytheon and 15% of all of these military industrial companies that are making decisions and then writing bills for legislators to pass.
I got to tell you, this is
fact.
I don't know. I feel like you're as bad as the. No.
Look at the balance sheet. And listen, David, I invest in BlackRock. I invest in Raytheon. I invest in Boeing. But I'm telling you, these are the people that run the country. Larry Fink legitimately runs this country because he has representation at the highest powers and buys that representation in Congress, period. It's pretty easy.
I don't even know how to address this.
If you follow the money factually, if you look at their balance sheets, it is clear as day who controls the market, the economy, the price of oil, everything. And it's not the president of the United States.
I got to tell you, listening to this, it makes me wonder how nuts Democrats sound when they accuse the Republicans or at least the nationalists of
two wings, one bird. No. It's not insane. It's fact. How do you know what Larry Fink's relationships are with all of these entities?
No, and I don't want to. I gather he's a wealthy guy who's in control of a lot of corporations directly or indirectly. I can guess that.
Yeah.
But I have trouble. In my naive Midwestern upbringing, I have trouble buying into the notion that there's a cabal that's controlling everything.
I didn't say
John Ludlum novels.
No, and I didn't
exactly
say
what they were all about.
I didn't say cabal. I said that he controls the interests of his own corporation, which is BlackRock, right? Which is a spinoff of Blackstone, which controls a whole lot. He's only worth personally about $1.2 billion, but he is one of the seven.
I have partners. A little more than he does.
He's one of the seven BlackRock partners that make decisions that affect major industries in this country and beyond.
So what's your point?
My point is that he is a player that we don't hear about in the news, but that controls more about than the people we hear about in the news. That's what I'm saying.
Well, but you're changing the topic. I'll argue you're changing the topic. So now we've gone from, okay. So now what you're saying is that I thought we were talking about Citizens United and the democratic process.
Right. So if he is the epitome of corporations are power and corporations are speech, and therefore corporations are people, and Citizens United open unlimited dark money into these campaigns, then people like Tim Mellon, who are bankrolling, and Tim Mellon is the grandson, the scion of Andrew Mellon, right? And he is bankrolling Trump's entire campaign right now, period. That's fact. That's a fact.
I don't know how to respond to this.
Because you haven't read the fact. It's a fact that Tim Mellon is bankrolling Trump, right?
I don't know, but let's assume. Well, I don't even know that's true. I thought Trump was bankrolling Trump. Mm-mm. That's the last I heard.
Mm-mm. Trump doesn't have two nickels to rub together, David. Trump is broke. Well, he's a bankrupt, quote unquote billionaire. He says he has over 400,000 or 400 million in liquid capital. But he doesn't, and he's going to miss his bond on Monday, and he's going to get his assets taken. And if he doesn't, then there's dark money involved.
Oh God! You know, I just I don't even know how to respond to all this. I have this naive view that. So let me clarify the things just quickly. Okay. I feel like there's a democratic process that involves elected officials. That involves a court, that involves enforcers and the Department of Justice. And it's a big sausage making process that I naively believe kind of tends to work. I think Trump tried to push that. And Clarence Thomas's wife tried to push that. I don't know how many of their activities were illegal, but I got to think in the end, things will probably be about right. Then I don't deny that not entirely. And by the way, I am, as I talk to you, there is a Toyota, it's probably a Land Cruiser. Is that what they're called? No, what's the Land Rover? Whatever they are.
Land Cruiser.
It has the new white lights on it that
I got
to tell you, how many people go into epileptic fits seeing these lights? Because if you catch them out of the corner of your eye, they clearly flash.
Yeah, so yeah. Mirror. I've got an electronic mirror, so when I look up in my mirror, it's just a video, right? And I see those things on strobe, right? They're not solid lights; they strobe in my video. So you can definitely catch a stroke if you're doing that right. By the way, do you know how much BlackRock has under management? How much capital they have under management? Just guess.
Oh, a lot. It's a big number.
$2 trillion. Keep guessing.
$1 trillion.
Keep guessing.
$10 trillion. $100 trillion.
$10 trillion. They have $10 trillion under management, right? So they own a majority of companies on the NASDAQ, on the New York Stock Exchange, on other stock exchanges. They control capital, right? They make markets move.
Let me cut to the chase. Do you feel that when you go to the polls, it's a pointless activity?
No, I think that if it wasn't a pointless activity, they wouldn't try to stop you from voting or try to stop voter registration or try to, you know, invoke voter ID laws or otherwise. I think that it's a valuable exercise of our rights as citizens to cast our vote for elected representatives. I also believe that local politics gets a lot done and affects our life more than national politics. However, in the case of healthcare and taxes and our environment and our Food and Drug Administration, I think the federal government is under the control of a small group of the 1% that have all the assets. I think that's abundant thing.
Wait a minute. So let's, I would have thought, and maybe we're saying the same thing. I would have thought that a lot of healthcare policy is a big chunk of healthcare policy is determined by the citizens through their representatives. I would think a lot of it was influenced heavily by the fourth branch of government, which is the press. And I would also think that large corporations like Apple and Google, who employ large numbers of people, have a say in it, as do the healthcare providers through their proxies, whether it's Kaiser Permanente or the American AMA. So I think all those people play a role. I'm not thrilled healthcare costs are going up. And going back to my point, if you think your trips to the poll are not a waste of time, and I don't think they're a waste of time either, to me you're one small piece of a larger piece of the decision-making pie. And that, yes, probably whoever you mentioned from BlackRock probably does influence part of the decisions on healthcare through his companies.
Because they also own the insurance companies, right?
You and I influence them also.
And that might be true. I think one of the cases recently, and it's political influence rather than power, but when, you know, a number of voters decided they were going to vote uncommitted in the primaries, it got the attention of the president. It got the attention of elected officials to say, shit, you know, we could lose if these uncommitted voters don't follow us. So we need to change our course. So I think that it does influence because it shows public sentiment. But I don't know that it influences.
So do you believe that what's the guy's name with BlackRock? I keep forgetting.
Larry Fink. Larry Fink. You should know your president's name. He owns.
I don't care. I just, he's like name dropping. But there's some guy named Larry Fink who owns a large company that has a lot of influence. I get that. So in the end, I think we can both agree that there was something untoward about what Trump did and Trump's minions did. We can both agree on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think that you and I necessarily both agree about Clarence Thomas and his wife and all that stuff. But we're on a different topic now. And on this topic, I think that the stew that results, or the actors who play a part of making healthcare decisions, is a wide group of varying interests. But what's the matter with healthcare? It's kind of good.
Healthcare is great, but the matter is there's a middleman, which is the insurance company, that tells you what is covered and what is not, takes up a considerable amount of the cost, and the cost that you're paying towards your healthcare doesn't go towards your healthcare. It goes for paying for the insurance company.
Okay, wait a minute. So what does that have to do with, and Larry Fink, you're saying, has to do with that because he owns
all of the insurance companies, all of them, and he influences all of their policy. So that's a monopoly in the U.S., right?
My understanding is that what's called a third-party payer system, that's what we have, as opposed to, I think, Canada and certainly the, what is it called, the NHS in the U.K.?
Yep.
I understand that the jury is out on the obvious fallibility of third-party payer systems. I think this is a case where nobody has figured it out. I don't think the UK has figured it out. Canada hasn't figured it out. We haven't figured it out. But when I read an article yesterday, and I hate actually relying on facts, I think they were facts, an article yesterday
about
a British journalist who had a heart attack, wasn't sure he had a heart attack, stayed at home for a little bit. Wife talked him into going into the emergency room. After, in retrospect, it turned out he had definitely had a heart attack. And under the NHS, he ended up waiting, I think, till the next morning. It was some ungodly number of hours. And who knows how much additional heart damage he incurred. When I read that story, I thought to myself, NHS doesn't sound so good. Our system has a lot of gross inefficiencies in it. But I think we're still the number one country in the, I'll say universe, because no other countries have been identified in the universe.
No way.
We're the number one country in the universe. The universe? Universe, I only know 177 countries. Is that the right number, or 217?
So you're saying that we're ranked number one for healthcare?
I didn't say healthcare. You're right. I didn't qualify it. I meant we're number one. Generally, we're the number one economic power in the universe. Is that correct?
We're fading quickly. We're fading quickly. However, in healthcare,
we are number one. Okay. Yeah.
We're not number one in healthcare by any means. We're not number one by quality of living. We're not even in the top 20 for happy places to live. I mean, we are not doing fantastic. And for the amount of money we spend,
I am in the 60 and over crowd, and I'm in. Oops, sorry, you were breaking up. Good.
I was going to say for the amount of money, we are the number one spender, but we're not the number one quality of healthcare.
It's a complicated thing. Healthcare is not everything. If you're 25 years old and you're launching on a career, hopefully in law, a nice pursuit, then you probably care less about healthcare. If you're 40, you probably care less about healthcare. So I think that it's fair to say that the number one country in the known universe has to make decisions. We don't have infinite money, even though we're number one, and healthcare. Yeah, it doesn't quite come out as well, but some other things do pretty well. And by the way, what I was trying to say was, us over 60-year-olds this is the top one of the top 10 countries for over 60-year-olds. So I'm pretty happy.
All right, that's cool. So we're not moving to Costa Rica. I get that. I'm saying there's a lot of fat that we can cut out of the middle, that the middleman is robbing both the medical practitioners as well as the patients. David, I paid. All right. Let's talk about entrepreneurship, because entrepreneurship and innovation is where we're at. Right. As a sole proprietor last year, I spent $50,000 on health insurance and healthcare.
Yeah.
50 grand. Yeah. You should not have to pay $2,500 a month for a premium for a healthcare plan in the United States in order to have adequate healthcare to cover you and your family. You shouldn't have to pay that much, period. So,
I shouldn't have to pay $32 a pound for Chilean sea bass. But in point of fact, that's what the market says it is.
But again,
and to be clear, I've never bought it. But OK, yeah.
It's relatively cheap compared to St. Thomas, where you about to pay $50 a pound for scallops. But anyway, so what I'm trying to get at is there's a lot of people in the middle of that process between me and my doctor that are taking my money and not giving me any benefit for it. So healthcare would be better, costs would be lower if you cut out a lot of the nonsense in the middle, which is controlled by the insurance companies. Which controls the lobbies, which control your legislators, which is why you won't get lower healthcare costs, because Larry Fink controls all of those insurance companies.
Why is it so easy for people on the right and the left to fall into conspiracy theories?
It's not a boogeyman. It's the fact. He's a $10 trillion hedge fund manager, right? $10 trillion in assets that controls the market. So it's not the free market that's controlling the price of healthcare. It's people like Larry Fink and Steve Schwarzman, right? Who are the partners at the largest holding company in the world.
Why
is the cognitive dissonance so thick?
Because this is point of fact, we have a pretty good, we're the number one country in the universe overall. We make decisions democratically about what we're going to put money into. We have a healthcare system, which seems to me in many regards is better than a lot of the other ones. I understand this is a super difficult problem to solve,
sure,
which is to provide to support high-end research in medicine, to provide healthcare to a large population that's super diverse. These are very tough issues. And it doesn't surprise me that any given country at any given time doesn't perfect them all, because nobody has an answer to this. And I think it's very convenient. And number one, you don't look like you're in such bad shape to me. So I'm thinking to myself, you are clearly complaining about a first world problem. I think the bigger question is, how do we handle healthcare in some poorer countries or the world as a whole?
But that's fair.
I find it very difficult to get worked up over the healthcare system of this country until you show me that there are proven better alternatives. And I'm positive you can't do that.
Oh, so I definitely can do that.
Instead, what you do is you find something you don't like. Well, no. You find something you don't like, the amount you paid last year. And it's like, okay, I'm sorry you paid that much, but in point of fact, you look like you're doing pretty well. To me, you don't look like the creature I saw on Star Trek last night. A bit of boils all over. So I think you're doing okay. And it turns out the $50,000 or whatever you paid is commensurate with sort of the standard of living in this country. And it's not so bad. Sure. Could it be better? Well, I know people have been studying this for decades and they haven't come up with anything better. So sure, let's tweak it here and there. But I'm not going to start blaming Larry Fink and whoever the hell else for my problems. The point of fact is, this is just the way a capitalist system works and democratic capitalist system works, and it ain't so bad.
Wow. You've clearly been gulping Kool-Aid. There has to be a more profound way than saying we're the best. Did you ever see Jeff Bridges? Oh, not Jeff Bridges. What's his name? From Dumb and Dumber. Jeff Daniels.
No.
Was in a movie and one of the audience members in the crowd, he's standing in a high school and he's giving a talk and he's talking about capitalism and this country, and this girl stands up and she says, or this young lady stands up and she says, "Can you explain to us why America is number one?" And he said, "I don't think you know what you're asking. America is not number one in anything. We're actually the bottom of a lot of countries in terms of healthcare and quality of life and life expectancy and all these other things." So I think clearly there's a disconnect between the facts and your opinions on what is going on in this country today. I'm not blaming Larry Fink. I'm observing that he controls economic policy and is the top of the capitalistic heap where he has unlimited access to power under things like Citizens United, decided by a corrupt court, including Alito and Roberts and Clarence Thomas.
It's such horseshit.
It's following the money.
Who are you to say it's a corrupt? Who are you to say it's a corrupt? Exactly what the Republicans of again. It's this. It's mudslinging and name calling. I would
not
say
if it's
that
based on facts. Not if it's based on facts.
Well, no. It's selectively chosen facts. Selectively remembered facts.
Isn't that what any debate is, David? Is selectively chosen facts to support your opinions and your perspective? I thought that's what we were doing. So I'm the only one that mentioned a single fact in this debate, but the fact that I know that Ginny paid for buses and Clarence Thomas accepted buses and Sam Alito accepted trips and John Roberts, you know, is in bed with Trump and all these things, that's proof of corruption. And that's factual. That's not opinion. No, it's not a conspiracy. No, it's documented fact.
Ah, I will give you this. Let's for the moment assume they are facts.
Okay.
And let's be quite clear what the facts are.
Yep.
That Ginny Thomas, let's limit the facts. In the case of Ginny Thomas and the fact you alleged,
yep,
that she paid for buses. Let's assume that the one fact is that she paid for buses to the Stop the Steal rally. People to the Stop the Steal rally. That's a fact.
Okay.
I don't know, and I'm pretty sure John Roberts literally didn't sleep with Trump. I think what you meant is that actually, I'm not sure what fact was in there because I don't know how well they even know each other.
Oh, they know each other very well.
Okay. Well, I don't know. And Clarence Thomas, many of the things you said seem to correspond with New York Times articles I've read. So I'll go with those. But to go further and to say that he's corrupt, I'm not sure what that means. I'm not sure what the word
corrupt means. John Roberts, Alito, or Clarence Thomas, which one?
Well, let's go with all of them. I tend not to agree with their views, but I think the one thing I can say about all of it is, because I'm near the river here, I think we're all kind of rowing in the same direction. We're certainly all in agreement that we want to be on a boat that's in a democratic, not Democrat, but yeah, democratically
process.
And I think we're all in that same boat. They may be kind of twisting their oars in a different way than I'm twisting mine. And in the end, the ride is a little rocky. We're kind of all on the same page on that. So I'm not willing to call them corrupt. I don't necessarily agree with their views, and I'm not sure why they feel they can impose those views, but the system permits that. And until you tell me one of them has been bribed and Thomas doesn't get to that level, I'm not willing to throw mud on them like that.
Okay. Like that. And that's very noble of you. How does the Supreme Court, made up of individuals that make, I don't know, what do they make, about $180,000 a year? How is the Supreme Court worth?
It's probably less than the president.
Yeah, but they are worth a combined $64 million. $64 million.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Well, I think both Democrat and Republican appointees to the court write books and get speaking fees. But in general, I understand they do things that don't rise to the level of committing crimes, and therefore they're permitted to do what they do, and they're vetted. We don't necessarily agree with the people who are put up for vetting nor the process, but my understanding is they make money on the side. Some of them probably came to the court with money. Clarence Thomas seems to have been cut some breaks, but again, none of them seem to be crimes. And I agree with that.
They're definitely crimes. $25 million for John Roberts' net worth. Clarence Thomas has a net worth of $4 million. Sam Alito has a net worth of $10 million. Sotomayor, $5 million. Elena Kagan, $4 million. Neil Gorsuch, $8 million. Brett Kavanaugh, $2 million. And he came into the court nomination process with about $2 million in debt. That was paid off as soon as he sat for nomination. So there's definitely things that are happening. There's definitely people being paid off. There's people being bought and sold, and they're in the highest court of the land, and they're going to determine whether or not we have a democracy, meaning not Democrat or Republican, but a democracy after November.
They're doing okay. I think they're doing okay. I think their decisions will influence what happens in November. And I agree with that. I would actually say this. This has been interesting and great, actually. I've enjoyed it. I assume we're going to turn this into a podcast by cutting off the beginning and the end of it and putting music on it. it has nothing to do with innovation. But do you want to bring it to a close? I wouldn't mind. It's been about an hour. I've got about 20 minutes showing.
You're burning some serious gas at $4 a gallon. So let's call it a quit. And I've got a 3:30 meeting anyway. But it's been fun. Let's get some power, type music on there. And I will see you on the other side.